Greetings, and welcome to Talking Trek to You, where an expert and a noob boldly go through Star Trek episode by episode. My name is JG McQuarrie, and I'm here with my co-host Kev Kozar. Say hi, Kev.
Hi.
How are you doing this week?
Well, today we have to talk about a situation where all of our leaders in power are old and senile and not able to properly use their mental faculties. So this will be a nice escapism from the real world. Yay.
Excellent. That's the kind of level of satire that we've come to hope for with this podcast. Fantastic. Well, we are dealing with the deadly years, which for some of us is a worryingly close reality. And for some of us, well, Kev's a lot younger than I am. Let's just say it at that. But of course, we always have to have a guest with us. So welcome back to the podcast, Rachel.
Hello. I'm pretty sure I'm even younger than Kev. So yeah. I can do the Chekhov of this episode.
Okay, well, we'll try and terrify you into getting through it without having to freak out and get old. But no promises. So it's lovely to have you back in the podcast.
Thank you very much.
Let's just crack straight on with it. Kev, would you like to give us our usual introduction?
All right. Yes. So the Deadly Years sees the crew of the Enterprise beaming down to a planet for a supply run as they are en route to deliver a Commodore to a starbase. On the planet, the 20 and 30 somethings they expect to be staffed there are instead, four of them are dead of old age. The other two are super old and soon die of old age. As they try to solve the mystery,
despite the entire staff being under 30, which is wild.
That is too wild. Yes, they find Kirk, Spock, McCoy, Scotty, and the female yeoman with them, or lieutenant with them. There's a different female yeoman. They all start to age, and then Chekhov, who went down with them as well, is not aging. As Kirk ages, the Commodore declares him unfit for command. When the Commodore takes command, he then flies directly into Romulans and panics and freaks out. Meanwhile, Kirk, with McCoy, they develop a solution to inject adrenaline straight into them, which somehow cures the old age, which was caused by a comet, yada yada, technobabble. Basically, Kirk becomes young again and takes command and saves the day.
Lovely. Well, there's a plot, and well, I was going to say a plot and a half. Maybe half a plot might be closer to the imagination. But anyway, let's see what we think of this one. So, Rachel, you're our guest, of course. So, you want to go first. What did you think of this one? How did you find it?
You know, I've seen it before, obviously, or maybe not obviously. I've seen it before, and I didn't remember much of it, and it turned out that was because there wasn't that much to remember. It's very straightforward. It really is just suddenly they all get old, and then they cure the oldness. So it's a very straightforward episode, but had some, you know, interesting things to think about, certainly in terms of how the view of aging has changed since the 1960s.
Yeah, I definitely think there are aspects of this that show the decade in which it was made. It's a funny one. I think everybody is trying hard to kind of pull this off. And I think there's a lot of elements which are sort of commendable. But I think overall, it's kind of boring. And I think that's sort of the worst sin that an episode of Star Trek can commit. It doesn't always have to be a balance of terror. Sometimes you get Spock's brain, which can be just as entertaining, although for entirely different reasons. But the Deadly Years is just kind of that, like, we've kind of seen all this before. But it is trying reasonably hard in some areas, I suppose. It just doesn't always get there. But Kev, what did you think of it? Initial thoughts?
Yeah, there's a lot. The premise is really interesting. There's a degree of camp I really enjoy about how dramatic the music gets, how dramatic they treat this, an excuse to get the cast in old age makeup and do like silly old people impressions. But I think the makeup is also really well done. I think performances are really good. And then it just kind of peters out. They forget to put an actual story in, as you were sort of alluding to. It's so straightforward that it's just, we have a premise, we don't have a story that the premise can fit into. So it is just a shortcoming there. So yeah, I wish this was doing more. But yeah, we'll talk about what it does well and what doesn't when we get into more detail. Yeah. I guess I want to start with the most obvious thing, which is the makeup. I think, it, like I said, it's really well done. I
don't agree with you, so I'm interested to hear your take.
I mean, I don't know. It just looks like this is, it looks like, I'm trying to think of what the word is here. It's not obviously what a real old person looks like, but it is like elaborate in a way that is like entertaining and like old person. What's the word I'm looking for? Like theatricality to it. I don't know. That just, I just find that really interesting. It's like what For All Mankind does in its most recent season, where it's like, yeah, this isn't great, like Oscar film level detail, but it is just for like an episode of television on a budget. Like, I thought it, I liked the go big or go home attitude towards it. It would have been so much easier just to gray the temples and add wrinkle lines, but they really went all out.
They did go all out, but to me it was way overboard. It felt very like grotesque to the point of being unrealistic. It just didn't feel like, and part of it is, of course, watching this now, I know what all of those people look like when they were, right, when they have gotten old. So some of it is that, but so just noticing those differences. But to me, it just felt like, you know, random skin flakes. And it felt very like focusing on the grotesqueness instead of on actually making them look like they had age, especially when they reveal that like they're only like 70. Like, they're only, right, the equivalent of 70.
I think it kind of splits the difference. I with Spock, they kind of have the, just the, like the graying at the temples and like the shadows under the eyes. And I think it's quite effective. And Nimoy is very good at kind of playing Spock slightly knackered, slightly exhausted. Something I, as I approach old age, have a tremendous degree of sympathy with. Yeah. It's a really nice performance. And I think the makeup does do quite a good job in enhancing that.
I agree with Nimoy, but he is, of course, he's aged less than the others because they say that Vulcans age slower. So he does kind of have that, just adding a few wrinkles and graying the temples, where they're really like piling on these skin flaps on McCoy and Kirk in a way that I just found very distracting. And especially, we can get into it a little bit more later, but the way that they handle the one woman who's exposed is just a little bit ridiculous.
Oh, yeah. Our heavy air quotes, yes, favorite recurring subject on this show, the treatment of women.
Oh, yeah. And I mean, there's so much to talk about with the two prominent female characters in this episode. Yeah. And not all bad or all good. But the fact that, I mean, they really go in for that. The horror of aging is about, like, just that the worst moment for her, even though she dies, is when she sees a mirror.
Yeah.
So it is just like very, they really focus on this grotesquery and hideousness.
She's not wrong though. That was a stupid place to hang a mirror.
It is a stupid place to hang a mirror. I don't know why there's a mirror there, but it was just very like, well, she doesn't look like an old woman. She looks like, you know, she got hit with a death ray.
Right.
Which is what happened. So fair enough. But in general, like, I just think that, I wish that, I don't know. Like I said, Spock, I agree with you, but Spock was the one who wasn't overaged to that point because he's supposed to be still spry at 100, which is more or less what happens. Once again, you know, I was thinking a lot about how, especially Spock and McCoy, we do see on Next Generation when they are about this age. So that was an interesting, I mean, obviously, Kev, you haven't seen that, so different element, but both Spock and McCoy appear on Next Generation, and it is about the same amount in the future that they're supposed to be aged in this episode. So I did think about that as we were watching.
Yeah, I think, I mean, a lot of the aging material really feels a bit, like the makeup is trying to cover a lot of shortfall in the script, I think. And it can't. And that's not really the fault of the makeup, because it's the mid-60s, or sorry, late-60s.
What, oh, for sure. No, I
except,
yeah,
like planking a bit of latex on them. But I do agree, especially like, it's not even just like the latex. Like, the collection of cheap nylon wigs is really something to behold. McCoy's has got this thing halfway down his face, and it's like, it's such a weird, odd, like, I don't know, the hair is even kind of worse to me than the latex.
Yeah, but then I even felt like the actual old people were you know, the characters who were portrayed by actual elderly actors were kind of giving the vibe of being lit or styled for like real grotesquery. It was a little much for me. I actually looked this guy up. The man who plays Robert Johnson, the head of the studio, has the honor of being the oldest Star Trek actor of all time by birth year. He was born in 1882 and is the first person born to appear on Star Trek.
A 19th century Star Trek actor.
There's a couple, but yes, there's a few because, you know, there were people who were that age then. But yes, he is the oldest person to have appeared on Star Trek.
I mean, I think talking about the grotesqueries, as you put it, about the makeup, it's a good time to talk about how this episode handles aging directly. Mm-hmm. And yeah, it is so ridiculous. I guess people just did my charitable read of putting my head in that mindset of the times is people generally did not live as long back then. I mean, people, obviously there are still Star Trek actors alive today, but like their parents or grandparents who they're seeing age up didn't live that long and had harder times in old age. So I can see why aging is a much more scary proposition for someone in the 60s than it is in the 2020s.
Yeah, I mean, some of it is also just cultural, that they're just coming out of the baby boom. There's that huge cohort of young people. And of course, they lost a generation of people, you know, in World War II and before that in World War I. So there were just a lot. The age distribution of the United States was just very different. But one of the things that I was thinking about a lot with regards to that is that in both the 2010s Star Trek movies and in Star Trek Discovery, it's established that the crew of the Enterprise are unusually young for Starfleet. Which both of that, as far as I know, is new to those modern interpretations. I don't think there's anything in any of the Star Trek movies about that crew that says this. But in Star Trek 2009... they're literally all Academy students when they take command of the Enterprise and leave on their mission. And in Star Trek Discovery, that's not necessarily the case. Some of them are already on the ship, but there's a lot of, I mean, obviously Captain Pike is much older than Kirk, but there's also much made of like how Kirk is moving extremely rapidly through the ranks. He's very young to be someone who may command a starship soon. And then, of course, all of the other Starfleet captains, even though they don't take place in the same time period necessarily, that we've seen have been much older than Kirk, who've led a show, and including the ones that do take place before that, like Pike and the various captains on Discovery, all older than Kirk. So there is this way in which our view of whether someone should be captain of a starship at 34 has changed to where that's considered basically... I mean, in this episode, there's no expectation that, like, well, at least we have a super young captain or something like that. There's no, and really, if you watch through all of Star Trek, there's no indication that they're an unusually young crew. But pretty much all of the subsequent revisiting of that time period in Star Trek history has sort of, without changing their ages, done this, like, surrounding retcon that they're now unusually young, even for the Starfleet of the time, which is never indicated in the original series. So something about their ages rang true for 60s audiences in a way that needs an explanation for 21st century audiences.
It's interesting that the one thing that they all agree on when it comes to these characters aging is that you're senile and then you'll die. And that seems to be the only option available to you. There's no suggestion that there could be any other way of approaching old age. And I think that's one of the places where this episode kind of falls down. We've had plenty of Star Trek episodes which have been happy to indulge in a more kind of philosophical analysis of their central conceit. The central conceit of this episode is relatively straightforward. People are just getting old. But we never get any sense that it's other than it's like old age is just a death sentence here. There is no sense that, you know, or like, you know, unfortunately, we won't get to experience the wisdom, or we won't get to acquire the knowledge that old age can bring, or we won't have the peace of mind or the wider perspective or the greater interpretation of life that old age can bring. And that's, I think, one of the things that's really badly missing from this episode. Everything is just treated essentially as, it's like a quest narrative. We need to find this. And how do we deal with that until we get to the solution? Then we get to the solution and everything's fixed, right down to everybody's haircuts. And it's just kind of like that's why this episode kind of comes across as boring. There's no interest in the exploring the concepts that the episode brings up, and that's kind of its fundamental flaw, I think.
One of the things that really made me laugh in this episode is McCoy, especially, who always kind of has, but as they get older, they start to act more like guys who were born in the 1890s. right. And but in ways that are very culturally specific, but that the show kind of posits as just sort of the universal thing that happens when you get to that age. And it's not, of course, it's a very culturally situated way of being a guy in his 70s that the show kind of posits as, no, even in the 24th century, like, this is how guys in their 70s will act.
Yeah, everybody either turns into Samuel Clements or Yosemite Sam, but those seem to be the only two options available.
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
Yeah, DeForest Kelly letting the Southern accent slip in more as he gets older is a fun touch, but it doesn't make sense for the other characters to do.
Yeah, I mean, the accent fits a little bit because I can see, like, if he's usually controlling his accent, and in this circumstance he's more, he's not in as control of his faculties, like, I can definitely see that. But it's not just that, it's like his attitudes become very 19th century in a way that's very right. funny, considering that if he's going to start acting like a guy in his 70s, then shouldn't he start like talking about back when the star bases were smaller or something like that? Right. I do find it funny. I was looking up. So Anson Mount is 51 right now, and Patrick Stewart was 47 when Next Generation started. So he would have been in his mid-50s when it ended. And it does seem like even to the point when they start hitting that mid-50s, early 60s point that they're already starting to be like, these guys are too old to run a starship.
Yeah. I almost feel like it's like specifically with the acting like people from the 19th century, it starts to become like, write what you know. This is the only old people they are aware of. And so, yeah. Of course, old people just act like that. And I don't know. It's almost like having a media history of old people attitudes changing throughout the years has almost gives us more perspective than someone writing a television show in the 60s. Like, I mean, yeah. It's not an entirely true thing, of course, but I think it does contribute something there.
I did look into this, and maximum age for naval officers right now is 62. So I don't know what the age was in I don't know what the age was considered in the 60s, if it has changed since then, but it does seem to be the case that you can't be a Navy officer unless you've advanced to a certain level past your early 60s.
God, I'm the same age as Anson Mount. How wow. I don't know whether to be cheered or depressed by that. I wish I was as handsome as Anson Mount and not have the age. I'd rather be a different age, but that handsome. I'd be quite happy with that as a compromise.
Yeah. He's a very good looking 51-year-old man. It does seem that in the United States, you're not allowed to command a battleship above age 62. for what that adds. And I was thinking about, because we discussed this last time I was on the show, thinking about once again the fact that, and especially thinking about it with regards to the Commodore in this episode, who we can get into a little later, but once again thinking about the fact that a much greater percentage of the adult male population were veterans at that time than are now. And the way that those military tropes are familiar, like I was comparing to like the way that Abbott Elementary feels familiar to most viewers. Not everyone went to a school like that, but enough did that it's a familiar setting. And that's certainly not true of something like NCIS. We watch that as being, you know, exotic. I think, you know, maybe the reverse would be true at that time.
Yeah. And I think the military thing also, like, maybe the writer's perception of how people age is influenced by like so much military service, because being in the military, I can see it aging you like mentally and physically in a way that, and also the smoking and also.
Oh like, yeah. I mean, people age healthcare. Differently.
Yeah. It's obviously, it just doesn't ring true to now. And it probably wasn't true for the '60s, but I can see how that perception would take hold in this writer's mind.
Well, there is some truth that just because of the way that various things are happening, kind of a perfect storm of factors, there were a lot more very young people in positions of power. And of course, this episode aired in 1967, so 4 years after the youngest president we've ever had was in office. So there were kind of a perfect storm of factors, including the fact that we had a young president for a while, allowing... there were a lot more young people in positions of leadership than pretty much any other time in American history. So there is some truth to it being much more of a norm. And part of that is because of World War II casualties. But there were like 50 different factors basically feeding into this, that there ended up being more younger people in positions of power. And now at our current time, we have more older people in positions of power than most times in American history, again, for a large variety of factors. So it's an interesting contrast to look at.
Yeah. Even the current president at the time, Lyndon B. Johnson, he was about to turn 60.
Yes.
And he was like definitely much older than Kennedy at the time. So it's just like, yeah, that's a great point where, yeah, it's our perception of leaders were different. Like, there's also a more mandatory retirement age at a certain
point. But also, just if you look at, you know, CEOs, there were a lot of new corporations at the time. So there were suddenly jobs like CEO existed more than they had in the past. It was the time of bureaucracy expanding, so there were a lot more, you know, people who were recognizable government leaders, that those positions existed more, so they had to fill them. So those jobs were getting filled with younger, less experienced people because the jobs had been newly invented and had to be filled. So there were just a lot of people having those roles at very young ages.
I mean, it reminds me of like Mad Men, which I've currently have seen three seasons of. You have Burt Cooper, of course, who's old, but then everyone under him, even like Roger's the next oldest, and he still looks, John Slattery still looks great. So
Roger is supposed to have fought in World War II in Mad Men, so he's supposed to be about, you know, if you actually think about it, he's in his 50s. Like, he's not, you know, he's not in most offices now, he would not be like the emeritus, you know. And there's a lot of frustration for Pete Campbell on Mad Men about how he isn't in the upper echelons of leadership at his firm before he reaches 30. And I mean, even the idea, I can't see, you know, Strange New Worlds or Discovery setting an episode that starts with a science research station whose entire staff is under 30. I just can't see that being something that wouldn't get changed if they were to do an episode like this now.
I mean, like we previously said, Anson Mount playing Pike, Anson Mount is in his early 50s, and we sort of assume Pike is that same age, and it's he's not senile, no one's asking to step down.
Yeah, if anything, we assume Pike is older than that because we've had some establishment that people live longer in that time period, and we expect as viewers of science fiction for people to be living longer. So, which is also interesting that it doesn't come up in this episode, because there's a lot of discussion of how Spock will last out longer than them because he's Vulcan and they live longer, but there's no real there's no indication that humans live longer or are healthier longer into their lives than the people of the 1960s do, which I think would be very strange. I would find it notably surprising for even remotely positive science fiction of the 2020s to not indicate that people either live longer, are healthy longer, or likely both. Like, I think that's just in the sense that, you know, science fiction of the 1950s would have flying cars. Science fiction of today has people living longer. It's just a very background radiation aspect of the setting that doesn't show up in this episode to a degree that was very surprising to me, to the point that when Kirk is like falling apart, they're like, oh yeah, he's about 70.
I think it is interesting that Commodore Stocker is visibly older than pretty much yes. most of the crew. Charles Drake was born about 20 years before William Shatner, so he's about 20 years older, roughly, than Kirk. And there is kind of that. I said earlier that there is that slight that lack of an interrogative aspect, which kind of drags this episode down. But the fact that Commodore Stocker is a little bit older is the closest the episode actually comes to doing anything with that, because we get to see like the visible difference between William Shatner and Charles Drake. And although Commodore Stocker is older, like he has no command experience. He doesn't know what he's doing. He makes a mess of it the first time he sits in the chair by making what is just a forehead-slappingly stupid decision, which is clearly only made because it gives Kirk the opportunity to sweep in and come to the rescue. More sort of very clunky plotting. But it is interesting to see that, you know, at least when it comes to the Commodore, they've made the effort to try and cast somebody who's a bit older. And so we do get to see a bit of a contrast there. Actually, I think the Commodore is a very interesting character. He's very unusual in Star Trek because he is actually sympathetic. He's like, we've come across so many sympathetic to a degree. We've come across so many nut jobs in Star Trek, you know, crazy admirals who can't see the wood for the trees, or like the Doomsday Machine, where we have a rolling eyed loony trying to take charge of the ship and drive it down into the jaws of an ice cream cone or whatever. Like, Commodore Stocker seems like a really nice guy. He seems genuinely motivated to try and help the crew, to try and help the people on the ship. He has his own deadline to keep, and you know, that's one part of it. But he's not he's not just one of these like tedious stock rule-bound characters who only exists to provide a contrast to our regular characters and to provide to prove that our regular characters are correct. Like, he's trying his best to do the right thing. The fact that Charles Drake underplays everything, he's not aggressive, he's not confrontational, he's sad about what it is he has to do. I really like that. I think that's this episode's cleverest touch, to have him actually have a completely legitimate point of view, and for it not to be this adversarial, well, you say, I say thing. Of course, we have the court hearing, but it's not something that anybody wants to be involved in. It's just a very sad act of necessity. And that's great. I really appreciate that about this episode.
I mean, I do take your point, but I also want to point out that his entire goal is just to not be slightly late to Starbase 10.
Like, right.
His whole deal, like, because like his motivation is really just that he doesn't want to be late to Starbase 10. Like, he really says this again and again. And he does say at one point, like, I think we'll have better resources there to cure you guys. But he never, like, really digs into that or, like, has much of a disagreement about it. He really just does not want to be late. So I do feel like, and this is, again, where I was thinking about the, like, military tropes, your MASHes, your Beetle Baileys or whatever, that this is very much the guy who is privileging protocol over maneuverability. You know, it's very familiar trope that, you know, we laugh a lot, again, bringing in the newer Star Trek shows. You know, I think watching them in the 1990s, 2000s, 2010s, we watch those and we're kind of laughing at that Star Trek trope of the desk job admiral who is addicted to being really boring and wanting everyone to follow the rules. And it's funny to think about, well, when this started, it was a military trope, not a Star Trek trope. It really came from the same place as, you know, again, like your Beetle Bailey or whatever. So I was thinking about it a lot as I watched. But I do think it's very funny that this guy really is about to start a war with the Romulans just so he's not like a couple days late to Starbase 10.
Yeah, it's like how the episode itself is like an interesting premise, a lot to dig into, and then really do much with it. Like, having a morally great, sympathetic motive, but also unsympathetic motive Commodore here, but then he winds up just being so one-dimensional. Like, the idea of, you see where he's coming from, but he's also kind of a dick, but he's doing what's necessary. Like, that push and pull tension is kind of rendered moot by, like you said, Rachel, his motivation at the core of it is, I just don't want to be late.
Yeah, I mean, he would be really sympathetic if he, you know, he's not wrong that Kirk is not right. doing a good job commanding the ship. And he's also not wrong. Like, in theory, as a viewer, I have no idea. He might be right that they could be cured better if they would just go to the starbase. My thinking as a viewer is also, like, how do they know that the radiation isn't still there on the ship, like, when they're in orbit? Because they've had that happen to them on other episodes where whatever hit them on the planet hits them in orbit, too, just takes a little longer. So I was like, I do kind of feel like you guys should leave. But this guy really goes about it in this way that's just not cool.
I should emphasize that I think a lot of the sort of redemption of that character is really in Charles Drake's performance. I do agree with what both of you are saying. You know, on paper, that's exactly how it reads. Like, he's just like this pretty little paper bound sort of like, well, I'm going to be late. That's just not acceptable. But like, it just, I just really love the way that Charles Drake plays it. He plays it with a sadness. He plays it with regret. He plays it with that. Yeah, he has his own motivation, but it's very much putting something on the screen that's not there on the page, and I think it makes the difference between a character and who you cast in that character really clear. Because if you had just cast somebody who was like bolshy or like trying to push like the confrontation or whatever, like, that character would be insufferable. But we don't have that. We have this regret. We have this, like, he doesn't want to do this. And yeah, he does have a legitimate point of view. Kirk isn't in a position to be able to do that anymore. And that drives a wedge. And the wedge that it drives between Kirk and Spock is also really interesting as well, because we have that scene with them in Kirk's quarters where Spock is sort of saying, you know, I don't really have any option in this. And Kirk is, well, just get out. I never want to have to look at you again. And there's...
Which is a fascinating
It really
quote.
Is, because we have never really seen that side of the friendship before. That, like, there's something in Kirk where he does have, like, some kind of resentment towards Spock. And we know that you always wanted to get my command. We know that's absolute BS. That's never been the case. But it seems like there is some kind of, like, genuine tension there that we've not really been privy to. And when Kirk feels that his ship is being threatened, that means even more to him than, like, this basically unbreakable bond that he has with Spock. That, again, is such an interesting moment. I think a little we could have stood to have a bit more of that in the end, but like, Nimoy's absolute regret as he walks out of the quarters at the end of that is just, it's breathtakingly good moment from him in an episode which has very few.
You have to wonder if, yeah, and you wonder in that moment if Spock is thinking about, he, even if they are healed, he will outlive Kirk and he may have to actually do this for real one day. You know, it's made very clear in the episode that Spock is going to be healthy and able to work for much longer than the rest of them. Although he's going to need his quarters to be 125 degrees.
Yeah, I don't know if that has held in continuity.
I'm not sure either.
I do think in general the best parts of the episode are the ones that use the characters rather, like, the sort of character asides rather than dealing with the main story, which we've already had criticism for. I also really like McCoy and Chekhov's sort of running thing where, like, Chekhov is complaining about all the tests he has to do, and McCoy is getting increasingly ornery with him as he gets older.
Walter Koenig is so good in this episode.
Oh, yeah.
It is very funny, the first scene where he sees the dead body and he's so freaked out. And I was just like, you see a dead body, like, every week. Like, what is going on here? But then there's actually a story reason for it.
Right.
But he gives a really good performance in this episode. Just going back to that Kirk and Spock moment, not to be the one who always not to bring it back to the Kirk Spock / Vic place, but I do feel like that reaction of Shatner's of, I never want to look at you again, is just such a great like little Kirk and Spock / Vic moment where bringing it to that place of not wanting to look at him. It's just such a fun, you know, I have to imagine that the girlies back in the day were having fun with that scene. Maybe not having too much fun with the rest of this episode, but But it's just such a fun little moment that brings in that dynamic.
Yeah. In general, I think this speaks again to season two's strength with, with Gene L. Coon and DC Fontana behind the scenes, like really having a strong grasp of these characters and knowing what notes to give. So you have those extra scenes like that. I mean, you also have Sulu and Uhura at the trial, like giving these very great testimonies for Kirk, but then also Nichols and Takei also really play like the regret when they have to like reveal how he's not been giving the best orders. Like all that stuff is really good.
Both of them are just so in character with nothing to do in this episode. Also, Uhura has some like very cool earrings in this episode that I very much enjoyed. I was shocked to realize that the director of this episode was the director of Sitting on the Edge of Forever. He is actually, I think, I'm just bringing in more Wikipedia. He directed tied for the largest number of original Star Trek episodes directed, including The Trouble with Tribbles as well.
I think we've shouted out Joseph Pevney before, but yeah, he's like a really... He's probably the most reliable director here.
Yeah, but it's just fascinating that he did City on the Edge of Forever and then this insanely boring one.
that trial scene is exactly why I think that this is a boring episode. Because I completely agree with you that Nichols and Takei are doing like really good work in that episode. I think everybody is. Shatner's doing his best as well. But we basically have like a 10-minute scene that is just telling us what's happened in the previous 10 minutes. It's like I know that's always a danger when you have like a trial scene or like somebody who's been court-martialed or like anything like that. But this episode just has, you know, we get to see Kirk make the mistake with the code, and we get to see him make the mistake with the signing of the fuel consumption report, and then 5 minutes later, we get to be told about Kirk making the mistake with the code, and we get to be told about. So we know, we've seen that. It's so repetitive. It feels so much like padding.
Yeah, I mean, it's also like later on, they get into a shooting match in the neutral zone, and they don't make the stakes of that like present at all. It's just not there. Like they're worried about the ship getting destroyed, of course, but it's like, guys, this could be a world-ending tragedy.
Nobody involved in this thinks there's a world-ending tragedy around the corner. And that fundamentally is what's wrong with this episode.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Like, it's just, it keeps escalating, but the emotion never escalates.
Right. I think it's very telling that the screenwriter of this episode, David P. Harmon, would go on to be like one of the big writers on Gilligan's Island and do a lot of sitcoms after this. Because... just the nature of the story, it feels like it should be, they should have leaned more into comedy if that was where it was headed, because it's clear that he does not know how to write the dramatic stakes as well. And
yeah, I mean, I brought this up earlier, but the episode starts with this bizarrely overdramatic reaction of Chekhov's to seeing a dead old guy, just like fully over the top. And then it stays at exactly that emotional key the entire time. No ups, no downs.
And at first I was really into this episode because that's like such, like, again, there's like almost a camp element to it where it's like treating this so dramatically when there's not much dramatic happening. But eventually it starts to set in, there's not much dramatic happening. And it wears out its welcome, the premise, when there's not much more to it.
Remind me, is there a captain's log in this episode at all? Because it doesn't start with one. And I don't think there's one after the titles.
I think he says one after the titles, where he talks about the routine mission. I'm seeing it on Memory Alpha, yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so it starts without a captain's log, and it actually starts really abruptly to me. It's almost... It's not quite, you know, in the midst of anything. It just starts with them already on this planet, but just beginning their mission. It was a very odd beginning of the episode to me.
It's almost to the episode's credit that they get to the premise so quickly. It's just then once they're at the premise, there's just nowhere for it to go. It just takes very slow time getting to the end of it.
It was just a place where I felt like we could have benefited from some narration to know what the heck was going on. Do we want to talk about the female characters in this episode?
Oh, I mean, I think we have to, but what are you supposed to say about it is other than, it's the 1960s and this hasn't really gone terribly well this time out, has it?
Yeah.
I mean, you know, the endocrinologist who's in love with Kirk is a fascinating character, yeah. in that there's so little going on there. Her performance is bizarre.
She gets kind of the same treatment as the Commodore, where it's like,
yeah,
the actor is clearly trying her best, but
to do something,
yeah, to do something, yeah. within a very cliche framework. I mean, they even, not only is she an old flame of Kirk's who has resurfaced, they even, I think, reuse a line from an earlier episode where she counts off the months and days.
Yes, and then they talk about her, like, old guy, also an endocrinologist husband that she married to get over Kirk, has just died. Right. which also, like, and then they don't resolve that storyline at all. Like, they don't go back to it. But the way that the actress performs the role, she's doing, like, a little, like, Glynis Johns, like, bit. I don't know how to describe it. She's doing this voice that's very, like, floaty, yeah. and it just is, it's not on the page at all in who the character is.
Like, almost like femme fatale.
Yeah.
She is a Tony nominated actor.
Yes.
Not for this.
A lot of stage work. Yeah.
No, I mean, and like, even for a Kirk old flame, there's just something about her that I found very strange. Although, again, like, there is that aspect of feminism, I guess I call it, in that it's not like there were that many women endocrinologists in 1967, right? You know?
Yeah, I think it's part of that Gene Roddenberry progressive, yep. one step forward, one step back, one step to the side, all at the same time mindset.
Yes.
Where, yeah, it's, we have female doctors, but they can only be on the ship if they're Kirk's past flame.
Yes. Or more, it feels more like the opposite, that it just happens that he has slept with every female professional, right. in the world. Like, that exists.
Yeah, that's canon. Although, I have to say, nice dress.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, it's lovely. I mean, it is also funny that Kirk gets so reliably horny for, like, doctors and lawyers. Like, that's his real type. And I know the reason is because, like, that's the kind of character they need to have come in on episodes. But it is very funny that, like, it's always a professional like that. Like, he never really is into, like, these women that are just, like, ordinary women. It's always women who are in the professions particularly. Because he never has flings with Starfleet women. I think that was something they avoided for various reasons. But it's always these ancillary professionals, scientists, doctors, lawyers. And I think that's, you know, in context, there are structural reasons for it, but I think it's fun to think about that being Kirk's taste.
Yeah, the performances are really trying a lot here. And I think, as we talked with our two most notable guest stars, they're kind of running into the wall of, like, there's not much this character can do in the framework of the story. And so, like, I think Charles Drake is able to add more to his character than Sarah Marshall is, just by the nature of what that character does. But yeah, in general, I mean, I think we're circling around this, so I would want to just get into the lead members' performances. It's just a well-performed episode in general. I think we talked a little about Nemo's performance in that one scene, but I think in general, he's doing such a good job throughout. He's really adding the years in, like, a, because he has to be, like, more subtle about it, because he's not dealing with the big makeup that lets him overact. He's really just sort of putting in the work of internalizing that age, and it's so good.
Yeah, he's really amazing at it. And again, we get to see the reason that this core cast are where they are. I mean, there's so much good material. There's a couple of moments where William Shatner kind of tips over into self-parody. But for the most part, he kind of keeps it together. He's very good in the trial scene, where he's just mm-hmm. things are just, like, slipping his mind and all that. So that material is well put together. I do find DeForest Kelly maybe just pushes it a little bit too far in this episode. He's just maybe laying it on with a trowel when maybe just a little delicate touch would have been sufficient. But you know, he fully goes for it. Like, he embraces that side of the character and sort of works through it. Our aging ladies for you know, let's face it, the episode isn't going to treat them any better than that. Variable degrees of okay, but this the standout here for me is unquestionably Nimoy.
Shatner in this really reminded me of what Joel Kinnaman does in, like, seasons 3 and 4 of For All Mankind, which is an also a performance that is really good in parts and a little cringy in others, but at least he has something for him to really grab onto that he's having fun.
It's a whole thing. All right, and I think with that, we can probably start to wrap up our discussion of this episode. Not our longest episode ever, but, you know, it's just sometimes how it is with these episodes. But let's move to our scores. I'm going to treat myself this weekend. I'm going to go first, and I am going to give this... Oh, I don't know. 5? It's not a complete bust, but it's kind of a snooze fest. It's sort of an old man sleeping in a chair in a retirement home somewhere whilst the trees gently lap against the window, which is, you know, nice, but it's not the most engaging thing in the world. So I am going to give it a 5. Kev, what would you like to get?
I'm going 1 point higher with 6, just because in my internal ranking system, 6 and 5 is the good and bad line. And I think just like those few key scenes, like the Kirk and Spock scene and like the few performance moments that really work, push this into an enjoyable time overall. But yeah, it's not much more than that.
I will say I'm a teacher, so I have very much in my head that on a 10-point scale, 7 is the pass line. And I do want to pass this episode, so I will give it a 7 in that respect. But I think being a teacher is skewing my ratings there. You know, if I were to view it as exactly evenly spaced, I'd probably be more in the 5-6 range. So I'll give it a 7 as a passing grade.
It seems unspeakably generous, but it is not my place to question other people's grades. Lovely.
Oh, I don't know. Like, I do go in that place of being a teacher and thinking like, well, if a student turned this in, I wouldn't fail them. I wouldn't necessarily give them any. It's not exceeding expectations, but it is meeting expectations.
Definitely not exceeding expectations. I think that's fair to say. Right. Okay. Let's leave the episode there and move on to our recommendations. Kev, why don't you go first this week? What would you like to recommend?
There is a new show on Amazon that I've seen 3 of the 8 episodes dropped, and it is called Second Best Hospital in the Galaxy. I really enjoy this. Is tweak to it the right phrase? I don't know. It twinge to it. There's something that I'm circling there, but
twig, I think.
What? Twig, yes. Think, right? There we go. That's what I was circling. It's, oh no, am I affected by the age comment? Yeah, it's a really good premise where, like, entirely sci-fi world, aliens running a hospital in an alien galaxy. And I am sort of, like, wowed that they managed to get away with not having any human characters, which, like, the closest comparison points. Like, it's kind of like a Rick and Morty or a Lower Decks in terms of, like, using a sci-fi premise to tell, like, adult animated stories. More on Lower Decks than Rick and Morty in terms of like how adult they get, but it is I just like that there's no grounding in humanity. Like, it's totally like every character can have cool alien deals and fun gimmicks and games to play. The cast is really incredible. The leads are Kiki Palmer and Stephanie Hsu, and then the supporting cast has like Kieran Culkin and Natasha Lyonne and Lennon Parham and Gary Anthony Williams. It's a really like veteran cast of good like comedians, and a lot of them have done voice acting as well. It's just like the procedural element of it, where it's like there's a new medical case of the week and our two like a little cliche, but like, you know, 30 and thriving women learning how to like be young professionals kind of thing, but they solve the case and deal with personal issues, and that's kind of all you want out of a show. And the situation's always very creative, the characters are very well drawn. If there's one issue, it hasn't had me like laughing out loud as much as like the easy comparison ones would be Rick and Morty and Lower Decks again, or like a Tuca and Birdie or BoJack, where it's clearly trying to go straw from as well. But I don't know. I'm willing to forgive like it not quite being at like a fuel gut busting level if like everything else is so creative and well thought through, and I'm really enjoying it. So don't know why Amazon is not publicized it at all, but it is sitting there on Prime, and it is like a really promising show from what I've seen.
Fantastic. Thank you very much. And Rachel, what would you like to recommend this week?
Well, I'll give you 2. So first of all, I have watched 3 different countries' versions of The Traitors reality show now, and I'm obsessed with it. It's great. It's like Mafia, the party game, as a reality show. I watch the UK, US, and Australia versions. They all have their little similarities and differences, and I'm really enjoying them. And I've also been watching them while eating these fancy little yogurts that come in clay pots from La Fermière. So I definitely recommend getting some fancy yogurt, watching many different international reality shows, and just loving yourself in that way. So those are my two recommendations.
Fantastic. Thank you very much. I'm going to recommend Apple TV is a regular stop by for this podcast. And I'm going to go for yet another one. I'm going to go for the series Constellation. As of broadcast, I've seen 4 episodes of it so far, and it's really interesting, which is my way of saying that this isn't a full-throated recommendation, but I think there's more than enough in it to make it worth watching. It's created by Peter Harness, who should be a name familiar to anybody in the Doctor Who world, and it's described as a psychological thriller. I suppose it is. It's got a lot of sort of weird time stuff going on. It's vaguely reminiscent of the Katie Sackhoff series, Another Life, which was on Netflix. But it's got a really stacked cast. Jonathan Banks is in it. Fantastic. James Darcy is in it. The main actor is Noomi Rapace, who honestly I find a bit boring. I'm sorry. I know that's not generally well-regarded opinion. She's kind of a bit dull, but there's just enough there to anchor it. The rest of the cast are great. It's an interesting premise. I'm very curious to see where it's going. It's certainly very well produced. A lot of, particularly the first couple of episodes, are very reminiscent of the Sandra Bullock movie Gravity, but done like really well on for a TV budget. It's astoundingly well produced for a show rather than a movie. I'm just really curious to see where it all goes. So if this isn't a full-throated recommendation to say that I love it, it's definitely an interesting time. And at least 4 episodes in, I think it's well worth going along with.
I love Peter Harness's Doctor Who episodes. And do you know the other Doctor Who connection with that show? Who's the creative consultant on it?
Oh, God, I do, and I can't remember. I know.
Rob Sherman, who we talked with
our friend Rob.
Yeah, who is just an incredible, wrote 1 episode of the televised show, but then an incredible like expanded universe writer for Doctor Who. And I don't know what he's contributing to Constellation exactly, but like I definitely want to give it more. I've only seen the first episode, which I thought was like you said, good Gravity-esque kind of thing, but I was a little annoyed that it still hadn't fully gotten to the sort of mind-bending premise the like log line and teaser seems to suggest. So I'll have to stick with it. But I definitely want to watch more. I'm intrigued.
Fabulous. Lovely. Right. Thank you very much. And we can also leave our recommendations there. Rachel, what would you like to plug?
Oh, honestly, I don't have anything to plug right now. Just having a good day, being happy in the world, being nice.
those are all worthwhile things to plug. Don't put that down. We could all do with a bit more of that. Yeah.
Yeah. Everyone be nice. Everyone, you know, I haven't done anything. Everyone be nice to each other. You know, that's what I'd like to ask you to do instead of checking something out for me.
That'll do just fine. Kev, would you care to tell people how they can get in touch with us?
Great. I am on Blue Sky at Max Rebo's Rody, and you can also listen to my other podcast, Total Massacre, where myself, Rowan Kaiser, and Carly Veloci talk about sci-fi movies. JG's other writings are at jgmcquarrie.scott, and his other podcast is Beatles Tophology, going through the Beatles track by track with Andrew Deacon. And then you can like, rate, review, and subscribe to this podcast to help other people find it. We're also on Twitter at TalkTrekToYou and Blue Sky at TalkingTrekToYou.
Lovely. Thank you very much. And Rachel, thank you for joining us once again.
Thank you for having me.
It's a pleasure as always. We will leave the deadly years there and move on. So next week,
just like you did at the end of the episode.
Yeah. It's all fine. My hair's back to normal. What do you want?
They really didn't even have him say goodbye to that lady.
No, she dismissed out of hand would have been better somehow than that fate. Anyway,
I can't believe I'm just remembering this now, but how Kirk got away from the Romulans. Fairly clever, pretending that he's going to explode the ship and then running away. I like that.
And nice little Corbomite callback.
Or was that a call forward?
I don't know.
No, it's a callback.
Okay. I wasn't crazy. Okay.
Excellent. Well, it's probably just old age muddling your memory. It's fine. It comes to the best of us. Don't worry about it.
It sure does.
Lovely. Right. We will leave it there. Next episode, we are going to be dealing with Obsession. And as always, it's not a Calvin Klein fragrance, but just another episode of Star Trek. And we hope you're going to join us for it. But until then, keep talking.